your questions today on the most unique book in the Bible.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, this is Michael Brown, and this show is in the midst of whatever's happening in the world around us, whatever's happening in society. We're just stopping and we're focusing on the Word, and we're focusing on the book of Job. I'm not taking your calls, but I posted on Twitter and I posted on Facebook and said, hey, I'm going to specially record a show just answering your questions on the book of Job. And when I look back, there were scores and scores and scores and scores of questions that had been posted. Boom, just immediately. So I'm going to get to as many as I can. Maybe we'll do another show, but I'm thrilled to see the interest in the book of Job. So if you don't know, I spent years writing this commentary that came out in October, Job, the Faith to Challenge God, a new translation and commentary. And even though there is the accumulation of many years of scholarly study, it is written in a way that any serious student of the Word can read and appreciate, and those that are scholars can dig deep and take what we've gotten from the book here. So I'm going to answer as many of your questions as possible. I do just have a small request. If you have the commentary and it's been a blessing to you, just post a review on Amazon as well as on ChristianBook.com. Post a review. It can be short, long, but if you've been blessed by it, encourage others, because commentaries, it's an interesting thing. You don't really think of commentaries being in that much demand, except in a certain, you know, circle of readers, and the publisher published a certain amount of volumes that they thought would last for the first year and a half being an academic book. Well, those sold out already, and it's ready in its second printing. So it looks like it's reaching the very audience that we want to reach. Okay, let us start with your questions, and let me grab them here on Twitter. I'm going to start on Twitter, then I'm going to go over to Facebook. Eric, do you believe the book of Job is a literal account or a figurative account? It must be literal in terms of that this man Job existed and that the core of the story is accurate. If it is just figurative, and I address this in the commentary, spend time on it. If it's just a parable or just a story, just, you know, someone made up this amazing story, it loses its force. It loses its power. Now, I could simply mention that Job is referenced elsewhere in Ezekiel and in Jacob, James. He's referenced there as a human being, as a righteous human being. And Jacob speaks of his perseverance. You sometimes hear it, patience. You've heard of the patience of Job, but it's the perseverance of Job that's being highlighted. So he is referenced as a real human being, not just a legendary character. But if I make some movie about Superman or Spider-Man or some other superhero, you know, whoever it is, courageous, that doesn't inspire you. That doesn't move you to action, because that's just a literary creation. That's just make-believe. If I have this amazing story of this cancer survivor that overcame multiple operations and death sentences from the doctors and ends up, you know, climbing Mount Everest and running marathons, and it's just fiction, what good does it do you? That being said, there is no question that then there is literary expansion by the author of Job. In other words, the poetic dialogue that we have is the creation of the author. So whatever the core speeches were, the core interaction, now that is taken and embellished in poetic form, beautiful poetic form. So the author certainly does that. But the core of the account, that these things really happen, that there was this man, that he was super blessed and famous, that he lost everything, and on, this is something that must have really happened. And the author also has the spiritual insight to know what was happening behind the scenes. A terrestrial earth. Terrestrial earth bird. What evidence is there that Job is the earliest book of the Holy Bible? On a related note, do we know who wrote it? We have no idea who wrote it. We have no idea who wrote it. There are some who believe there are multiple authors to the book. or at the very least that the author of Job added some additional material later on. I see one author of the book, but if there were multiple authors, that wouldn't affect anything. As G.K. Chesterton said, and writing about Job and the possibility of multiple authors, look, you see an ancient cathedral, and it's built over a period of generations with different builders and people working on it. That's not a problem. And again, either way, it's inspired by the Spirit. But we have no idea. We don't have a clue. We literally don't have a clue. As for it being the earliest book of the Bible, it's not. You often hear that Job is the oldest book of the Bible. It is not the oldest book of the Bible. In fact, it's probably written close to the time of the exile, or maybe even during the exile, the Babylonian exile I'm talking about. So it's written much later as opposed to much earlier. Now, the account of what happens in Job, I believe, is ancient. The account in terms of Job's life, and that seems to be placed back in patriarchal times. And Job is pictured as a righteous non-Israelite before there was a people of Israel. But the theology of the book, everything in it, is written as if an Israelite is reading it. And an Israelite is reading it who also has other portions of Scripture. Because within the book of Job, there are allusions to other parts of the Bible, or here and there an actual quote from another part of the Bible. So if I am quoting Ronald Reagan, then I lived after Reagan. If I'm quoting George Washington, I lived after George Washington. If I'm writing something, and I'm writing it in, the early days of the colonies, but within the dialogue, I am giving little quotes that sound like George Washington and sound like Ronald Reagan. You say, so you're writing this much later for an American reader to read that account through these eyes. So that's what's happening. And Job, we have other reasons for saying that it's a later book versus an earlier book. That being said, it's also written in an antiquated Hebrew to give it that feeling of ancientness as well. Okay, then a question: why don't prosperity preachers address God's sovereignty over Job's situation? Basically, there is a tremendous weakness with the carnal prosperity message in that everything's just supposed to go well, that you're supposed to financially prosper and be in perfect health. And if you love the Lord, that's the way it's supposed to go. Now, obviously, people know it's not always like that, but that's the impression you get when you hear the carnal prosperity message. Now, I absolutely believe in divine healing, and I absolutely believe that in terms of the general revealed will of God, that we can say that healing is God's will and God's blessing for his obedient children. I do believe in God's provision that he meets our needs so that we can meet the needs of others. At the same time, I categorically reject the carnal prosperity gospel. So those that preach it have to come up with excuses. Well, Job was walking in fear. You see, he said that, you know, maybe his children had sinned. And if they had sinned, you know, he's got to intercede for them. Maybe they cursed God. He was walking in fear. Or in the third chapter, the 25th verse, he says, you know, the things I feared have come upon me. So that shows he was walking in fear and opened the door to the adversary. First, in Job 1, he's pictured as being so righteous that he intercedes for his kids in case they stray and sin in the midst of their prosperity and blessing and curse God in their hearts. And in Job 3, he's either saying the thing I feared came on me. In other words, this is the opposite of what's supposed to happen, because the fears of the righteous are not realized. It's the fears of the wicked that are realized. How many things have you feared in your life that didn't happen? Oh, I'm going to die, but I'm not going to have kids. And here you are. You have kids, and the things you feared didn't happen. That's one way of reading it. That's the shocker. Another way of reading it is in the Hebrew, in the state that I'm in right now, whatever I fear is happening to me. It's just blow upon blow upon blow. The bottom line is Satan would not have needed permission from God to touch Job. You say, well, God said, no, look, he's in your hands. God said you can only go so far. Satan needed permission from God to touch Job. Not only so, God singles out Job and says that he is the most righteous man on the planet. There's nobody like him. And when Satan attacks Job, God defends him and says, he's holding fast to his integrity, even though you're moving me, inciting me to destroy him without a cause. So all the excuses, well, Job married the wrong woman, or when Job said the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, he was blaspheming God. I mean, these are so contrary to Scripture. But I've heard this from some prosperity preachers because they have to find some excuse for Job's suffering that fits their theology. I have an essay in the back of the book. I have a number of essays in the back of my commentary, Job, The Faith to Challenge God, where I look at larger issues, you know, Job and the new atheist, or what would Job say to a suffering person, or who is HaSatan, the adversary, Satan, in the book of Job, or how does Job compare to Jesus, and things like that, or challenging God as an act of faith in Jewish thought. And I have one of the essays is on the danger of holding to a too rigid orthodoxy, where you have to have your inflection, well, if you're righteous, you'll be blessed, and if it's going bad, you must be wicked. And because we don't want our own little world to crumble around us, we have to put people in either of these categories. So we address this in the commentary. Hey, David, thanks for the recommendation and the big bearded smile with the Job commentary. Michael, Job on trial, not God on trial. Drawn to the book of Job since my college days. So glad I studied it back then. Prepared me for life's trying times. God is transcendently wonderful. Yeah, the conclusion of the book is God is transcendently wonderful. That when God reveals himself to Job, he doesn't answer any of Job's questions. He shows his majesty, his beauty, his wisdom, his power. And that's how God reveals himself to Job, as transcendently wonderful. Let me say this while I'm there. That's one of the reasons for my subtitle, The Faith to Challenge God. On the one hand, Job spoke wrongly about God and accused God of wickedness and indifference and of being a moral monster. That was wrong. That was arrogant. That was sinful. On the flip side, Job rightly understood that God must be better than what he was experiencing, and that the God that he knew was a God of justice, and that the God that he knew was a God of goodness, and this was not the way it was supposed to be. And God ultimately said, Job, you're right. You spoke rightly about me in that respect. That's in Job 42, 7 and 8. But Job is on trial. God is on trial. Okay, so how is Job on trial? Well, that's obvious. The adversary, Satan, says that if you take everything he has, or if you take his health, then he'll curse you to your face, God. In other words, nobody serves God without benefits. Nobody serves God just because they love God or just because he's good. They do it for other reasons. No one serves and loves God with a complete altruistic heart. So God's saying, oh yeah, what about Job? So yeah, Job is on trial. But then, yes, you could say that God is on trial in that the question is raised, do people love him just because of who he is? And does he know how to run his universe? So, of course, God is gloriously vindicated in the book of Job. All right, we're coming back with your Job-related questions. So I just want you to understand, whatever's happening in the world around us today, we're stepping back from, and we're just digging into the Word together. So if you have a question, save it for, next Friday broadcast, where you can call in with your questions, or a Thoroughly Jewish Thursday if you want to call in with some Job-related questions. But right now, we're answering your questions on Twitter and Facebook.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on this special edition of The Line of Fire today. This is one of those travel days for me, commuting between different trips of ministry. And as we were praying and giving thought to which direction this show should go, I thought, you know what? I've been doing a lot of radio interviews on my Job commentary in recent days. And folks, I do a lot of interviews. I don't think they're just saying it, but the interviewers, the radio hosts, seem to really enjoy the interviews. We're opening up Job because, you know, you spend enough time focused, studying, praying over it. You get insights, and we've been able to share those with others. I thought, why don't I just see if you have any questions on the book of Job? So when I posted on Twitter and Facebook a few days back from when you're listening to this and said, hey, do you have any questions on Job? Post them. Suddenly it's like, there they were. I thought, okay, cool. There's this great interest. So if you don't have my commentary, this is it. Job, The Faith to Challenge God, a new translation and commentary. And maybe I'll read a little bit from the commentary, the new translation, so you can hear some of the way we word things. But not taking your calls, answering questions that have already been posted on Twitter and Facebook. I'm going to stay with Twitter for a little while and then move over to Facebook. Grace, many times the contents of the book of Job are used to support a belief that everything that happens is God's will. This language of God seeming to send some sort of negative things, sickness, spirit storms to people, seems to be repeated throughout the Old Testament. Is it true? To what extent are these things God's will? What is the best way to interpret? Okay, so first, we see that there are many things in Job's situation that are unique. and that he singled out of all the people on the earth by God. And God says, there's no man on earth like Job. So in that sense, he is a Jesus-type figure who suffers on behalf of others, who suffers not because of his sin, but for another purpose. Of course, Job is not like Jesus. And again, I have a special essay dealing with this in the back of the book, comparing Job and Jesus. Job is not like Jesus in that Job was still a fallen human being who needed a redeemer. So Jesus died for Job. Job didn't die for Jesus. But Job plays a unique role as this ideally righteous man who is going to experience the opposite of what would have been expected, especially from an Old Testament mentality of blessings and curses. Blessings for the righteous and curses for the wicked. He experiences what the wicked should experience, and that's what turns things upside down. But the message for everyone is that sometimes inexplicable things do happen to righteous people. And that's where Job stands in for everyone else to say that. At the same time, you see that God does not want to touch him, that it's the adversary, Satan, that takes his possessions and kills his children. It's the adversary, Satan, that smites him with a terrible disease. And God, in this extraordinarily vulnerable language in the second chapter, the third verse, says to HaSatan, the adversary, you are inciting me to destroy him without a cause. So God says there's not a cause. And then once Job has been humbled and worships God and learns his lessons and recants for the wrong things he said, what happens? The end of the story is he lives happily ever after, supernaturally blessed. So what we can see is that ultimately God blesses the righteous, either in this world or the world to come. We can see that the nature of God is reflected more in his restoring and his grace than in the smiting that Job experiences, and that the killing of children innocently, the smiting of someone with a terrible disease, that reflects more of Satan's nature when that happens to godly and innocent people. On the flip side, we often see the emphasis on disaster and plague in the Old Testament because of the constant disobedience of Israel, that you see more the side of God's judgment than you see the side of God's grace. Tom Eliyahu Bashir, what is the latest research on Job's Hebrew and some difficult words in it? There's a lot. I mean, throughout the book, there are difficult words. I honestly have to say that translating Job was one of the most tedious things that I've done academically. That normally there is more of a sense of a euphoria. You dig and you study and you learn. And that's what I got often in the commentary. I felt were insights and some I thought, wow, why don't other translations see this? And then I'd look at the best Hebrew scholars I could find, and others had seen it the same way I did, or spiritual insights that are very rewarding. It was very, very challenging in many, many ways. And I just want to reference this. At the beginning of the commentary, I do deal with the issue of the language and the dating of Job. And I'm just trying to see if I have the bibliography here or if it's in the end of the book. I may get that reference for you a little bit later in the broadcast. But there's an excellent study of the Hebrew of Job. Again, just looking for the exact reference here, the section in my commentary. Authorship and date. So beginning on page 10, again, we don't know who wrote the book, and I understand it to be written later in Israel's history rather than earlier in Israel's history. But I note, as for the language of Job, a complex issue to be sure, I believe the analysis of Chaney's, so this is Michael Chaney, his book, Dust, Wind, and Agony, Character, Speech, and Genre in Job. So it covers a wider range of issues, but really looks at the Hebrew. What I wrote there is, I believe the analysis of Chaney is correct, namely that the unique intertwining of linguistic features prompt the reader to think of ancientness and of foreignness. And then C.L. Soe, whose last name I probably mispronounced, one of the top Hebrew scholars dealing with the book of Job, massive commentary halfway through, about 1,000 pages in the Illumination series, he says he provides a detailed linguistic analysis and notes that, quote, the text is clearly designed to give the impression of an ancient time and a foreign place. So if you look at Cheney's book, or if you look at Sow's commentary, S-E-O-W, again, forgive my mispronunciation of his last name, you'll see detailed analyses of the Hebrew. And as far as specific words, they're so many. Antonio Majorano, what is the biggest lesson that Job learned after God asked him hypothetical questions back and Job apologized? A few big lessons. I would say the biggest is Job realized how little that he knew. That once he got a scope of the majesty, the majesty of creation, and thereby the majesty of the Creator, the wisdom, once he got the scope of all the things that he did not know, that was overwhelming. That's why he puts his hand on his mouth and says, as I translate, I recant everything. I take it back. The idea that he was more righteous than God, or could accuse God of injustice. Who gives you the right, Job? You weren't there when I created the universe. You ever seen some wild sheep or goat, give birth? Where are you? Tell me about the eagle flying, the horse. I mean, just the ostrich. Like, Job, what do you know? And then after that, Behemoth and Leviathan. These powerful creatures, which I take to mean and to refer to earthly creatures who symbolize demonic powers of chaos and darkness. God's like, you can't even touch them. And I created them. I master them. They're like playthings to me. So even though Job was right in saying that there must be justice in God's universe, and that something was wrong with the way he was treated, and that was not in keeping with the character of God, he was absolutely wrong to accuse God and to call him a moral monster and indifferent and wicked. It's like, Job, you have no idea what's going on. And to me, that was the lesson. The majesty of God's like, what in the world? What have I been saying? That would be an overwhelming reality. And then, yes, God is inherently good. let's see. Free. In the book of Job, there seems to be a lot of good verses just misapplied by his friends. So I always wonder if I can take some of those verses and personalize them for myself when they were spoken out of context. Seems silly, but never been sure. Oh, yeah. Great, great question, Free. For example, in Job 5, God takes the wickedness or the crafty in their own craftiness. That's true, isn't it? I remember one of the first times reading that, I thought, Book of Esther, Haman. What an illustration. Or Job's exhortation, Eliphaz's exhortation to Job, beginning in Job 5:17, I believe. That's great. It's wonderful. It just doesn't rightly apply to Job. So yeah, the friends spout orthodox theology. The wicked suffer. God chastises the righteous. God blesses the righteous. No one is more righteous than God. They spout orthodox theology, but it's misapplied. Job was not suffering because of his sins. He wasn't being disciplined and chastised by God. Job was not suffering because he was wicked. So when you take the verses out, again, to me, the strongest in the whole book would be Eliphaz in the 5th chapter, talking about God disciplining the righteous and borrowing some of the language from Proverbs, the 3rd chapter. That is just a beautiful passage, and maybe the most beautiful extended passage about what God does when he disciplines and chastises his people and the good that comes out of it. Beautiful. Praise God. Wonderful. However, it was misapplied to Job. And that's part of the confusion of it. I remember reading it the first time. It's like, amen. And then the next one, amen. Reminds me of the story of the rabbi counseling a married couple, and his assistant is there, and the husband explains how all the problems are the fault of the wife, and the rabbi says, you're absolutely right. The wife says, what? Are you kidding me? All the problems are his. All his, my husband's. And the rabbi says, you're absolutely right. And then the assistant says, rabbi, he can't be absolutely right, and she can't be absolutely right at the same time. And he says, you're absolutely right. That's how I felt reading Job the first time. So yeah, when understood rightly, those verses can be applied, but they were misapplied to Job. Okay, we will be right back on the other side of the break. I hope you are enjoying digging into Job and getting your questions answered as much as I am enjoying doing the answering.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, you are in for a treat today. We are digging into the book of Job, and I'm answering questions that you posted on Facebook and Twitter. So we're not talking about what's happening in the world around us. This is kind of a timeout from everything else, timeout from the culture wars, timeout from politics, timeout from what's happening in Israel. Just looking at this amazing book. And if you don't yet own this, when you can, I encourage you, buy this commentary. You'll find it absolutely worth every penny, every dollar. Job, The Faith to Challenge God, a new translation and commentary. And I'm going to start answering your questions on Facebook. But first, I want to read to you my translation of Job chapter 1. All right, Job chapter 1. There once was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And this man was full of integrity and upright. He feared God and turned away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him, and his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a large number of servants. So this man was greater than anyone else in the East. It was the custom of his sons to host a feast. Each one his turn came around. They would invite their sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of feasting had run their course, Job would send for his children and have them ritually purified. He would get up early in the morning and sacrifice burnt offerings for each of them. For Job said to himself, perhaps my children sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This is what Job did all the time. On a particular day, the divine beings came to present themselves before Yahweh, and the adversary came along with them. Yahweh said to the adversary, where have you come from? The adversary answered Yahweh, from roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it. Yahweh said to the adversary, have you considered my servant Job? There was no one like him on the earth, a man full of integrity and upright, one who fears God and turns away from evil. The adversary answered Yahweh, does Job fear God for nothing? You put a protective hedge around him, his family, and all that he has. You bless the work of his hands that his possessions have spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike all that he has, and he'll surely curse you to your face. Yahweh said to the adversary, all right then, everything he has is in your power. Just don't raise your hand against him. The adversary then left the presence of Yahweh. All right, to your questions, Ivan John. How was the fourth speaker after God intervened? I mean, the youth who spoke with Job. I'm asking this because I'm very curious of his perspective or insights. So Elihu comes in out of the blue and then disappears. Interestingly, his name in Hebrew is very close to Elijah, Elihu and Eliyahu in Hebrew. And he speaks more than any of the other friends combined. And he goes on for chapter after chapter, and then God speaks. And Elihu's gone. He's not mentioned at the beginning of the book. He's not mentioned at the end. Some see him as a later insertion, that the author of Job later in life or another author added him in. What role does he play? For many years, I asked students in ministry school in the 80s, when I would teach on Job, to write a paper on Elihu. And they were every year completely divided. Every year, right down the middle. Half thought he was amazing, and half thought he was a foolish young person. And then when I was teaching in a smaller setting, but more advanced students, master's level students and things like that, several students did a paper on Elihu. And to my shock, all three independently came to the same conclusion and then found similar views by Robert Gardus, one of the world's top Job scholars from the last generation. And each of them came to the conclusion that Elihu was an Elijah type figure who prepared the way for the speeches of the Lord. So I really thought this through, and then as I studied the text, you could go either way with it. Wow, it's amazing insight. This is prophetic. This is the Lord. Or like, and it's just bag of wind. What's going on? So my conclusion is that the ambiguity is divinely inspired. In other words, that you can see it this way or that way. It represents the limitations of human wisdom. It says, yeah, what the friends were saying was missing something. What Job was saying was missing something. So I've got to weigh in with additional thoughts, many of which are beautiful and wonderful. And yet it falls short and thereby prepares the way for God to speak. it says, okay, there's more to be said. There are more arguments to be raised. But in the end, God must speak. So that's my evaluation in short, but we get into it in depth in the commentary. Aaron, my Redeemer lives. Is he speaking of Christ? Is there any other Christological passages in the book of Job? I read the book in jail as a teenager. It's been one of my favorites since. Dark times, but it showed me the true joy of the Lord, the peace that passes all understanding, grace and peace to you. Aaron, the passage that would most likely refer to Jesus, not that Job understood Jesus or Job was looking for him, for Christ in a tangible way or had a concept of the Messiah, but Job 16, where Job is wishing that there was a mediator in heaven that would stand between him and God, that is the passage that would most apply to Jesus. When he says, I know my Redeemer lives in 1925, it's very natural for us to immediately think he's talking about Yeshua, he's talking about Jesus. But overall, it seems he's talking about God in general as the Redeemer that's going to rise on the earth in the end, and that Job will somehow see him, maybe even saying in a resurrected body. There's dispute about exactly how to understand the Hebrew there. But in any case, the most likely understanding is God in general, but it's Jesus who brings that to fulfillment in the end, as far as our perspective. The other thing is that Elihu, in the 33rd chapter, has an angelic figure, a mediator, saying, I found a ransom. And when he says those words, then that brings healing to the righteous person who's been sick and afflicted by God to be chastised, to grow more. That, in a way, is pointing to the cross and pointing to redemption. Lucas, I've been told by several people that Job is a poetic book and shouldn't be taken literally. I don't really agree, but I'm no scholar and would love to know your take on this. All right, I answered that in the first part of the broadcast. The book is poetic in terms of the dialogue, but Job is absolutely a historical figure, and the events, the core events, must be historic for the book to have its power. The dialogue is embellished with poetry, okay? But the core of the story and narrative is obviously historical. Louise Wardell, how come God had to prove to Satan that Job was faithful? Well, God didn't have to. God chose to. In other words, this was now a challenge in front of the angelic host. This was a challenge to the integrity of God. This was a challenge, and we have to read between the lines. But when obviously God calls all of the heavenly hosts together, including the adversary, HaSatan, Satan, calls all of the heavenly hosts together. And then he says to HaSatan, to the adversary, where you been? What have you been doing? And it's the Hebrew is curt enough that many take it to be rude and like, oh yeah, I'm going back and forth through the earth. Yeah, just doing my thing. And what I understand, reading between the lines based on God's response, is he's saying, I like the way it looks down here. There's a lot of rebellion, a lot of sin, a lot of wickedness, a lot of evil. Yep, looks good to me. This is your creation, God. Doesn't look like you at all. That's the insinuation. And in the classic words of Dorma in his French commentary on Job, that Satan insinuates himself among the sons of God. And God then says, have you considered my servant Job? And it was, oh yeah? You got everybody? You sure about that? There's nobody on the earth that's really righteous? Nobody on the earth that really worships me? What about him? Yeah, right. Take what he has and he'll turn against you. So there is now this challenge before the onlooking angelic host. And it is now a matter of God vindicating his name, and with that vindicating his servant Job. He's called my servant Job in chapter 1, chapter 2. But then after he humbles himself, after God's rebuke, after he humbles himself in Job 42, 7 and 8, God calls him my servant 3 times with pride, you can tell. let's see. I'm just going to try to get to one question only. Mercy, well, I got this book as a Christian Christmas present. Haven't read it yet, but would be very interested in hearing the show. I hope you're enjoying the show. Mark, what are the big theological lessons concerning suffering that Job is driving at that we must hear? I've heard someone say that Job is essentially 30-something chapters of bad theology, pointing to the comments of his friends. Do you agree? What do we need to understand about Satan's role in disease, natural disaster, trials from this book, life in this book? What are we to understand about God's recompense? The book ends with all great comments. Finally, please, how on earth would you tackle preaching through a book like Job? Advice on preaching this book well would be great. Okay, you asked a bunch of great questions, all of which are addressed in depth in the commentary. But here's how I preach through it. So that's what I'm going to answer out of all your questions and some of the others I've touched on in other parts of the broadcast today. I would first lay out the large pictures of Job. What am I going to learn from this? I'm going to learn that sometimes inexplicable things happen to the righteous. Sometimes inexplicable things happen to the righteous. Don't draw wrong conclusions from that. Don't draw the wrong conclusion that that righteous person must have secret sin and that's why the plane crashed, that's why the car crashed, that's why they have cancer, that's why their kids are sick. Don't go there, okay? On the flip side, don't do what Job did and make assumptions about God. Well, God must be wicked, or maybe God just sends disease and sickness because that's just what he likes to do. Don't draw a wrong conclusion about the person. Don't draw a wrong conclusion about God, all right? That's one thing. Recognize how little we know and persevere to the end of the book where we see God's heart to restore and bless. There are many. In fact, I have a special essay in the back of my commentary about the happy ending of Job. A lot of people don't like it. They don't like the happy ending because it's like, that takes everything away. No, no. Ultimately, the righteous will be blessed, if not in this world, then the world to come. And even in the midst of suffering, we can be blessed with communion with God. And what Satan means for evil, because he's the one that kills. He's the one that accuses. He's the one that smites. God doesn't do those things to his righteous servant Job. Satan does. Yes, I know under God's permission. But that reflects the enemy's nature to maul someone like that, a godly person, to kill their children. That reflects the enemy's nature. What Satan means for evil, God will ultimately turn for good. But this idea that it's just 30-something chapters of bad theology, no, no, no. First, it's showing us the rawness of Job's faith to say, hey, when you're in pain and suffering and you're lashing out, God understands. There's a whole book in the Bible that just talks about that. And sometimes it's because you have faith that you get angry. Like, God is not supposed to be like this. It's because of faith in who God is and his goodness that you may even have that attitude, all right? So, and as for the friends, their theology in many ways is right, but it's wrongly applied and it's too rigid. But if you're going to preach through Job, use the commentary because I think it's going to help with practical application all the way through. And friends, again, just a quick favor, if you've enjoyed the commentary, you're reading it, enjoying it, post a review on Amazon, even if you didn't get it there. Post a review there to let others know you're enjoying it. Maybe post a picture of yourself on social media holding it up. We work really hard on it to get to as many people as we can. Also, post a review on ChristianBook.com. We'll be right back.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we're going to have to do this again. When I just posted on Facebook and Twitter a few days ago and said, hey, I'm going to specially record a broadcast just answering your questions on Job, I really didn't know what response I'd get. But within an hour, when I looked back, there were scores and scores and scores of questions between Facebook and Twitter. So I'm getting to as many as I can, but trying to answer in sufficient depth that it makes it worth your listening. And this is on my mind. The commentary came out in October, and then a few days ago, I got the second printing. That is cool. They already ran out of the first printing and had to do a second printing. They weren't thinking they'd need a second printing for 3 years. Instead, it was like 3 months. So that was a blessing. That really thrilled my heart because I worked hard on this, and I did it before the Lord, just really wanting to honor him and accurately convey his word and convey things in translation. It's, commentary work and translation work is very sacred, obviously, as is all preaching, teaching, expositing the word. But when you're putting it out and writing, and there it is, you just want to do your best to bring your part and help others as best as you can. But I've been doing a lot of interviews on the radio on Job, and I thought, well, people seem to really enjoy the interviews, and the light seems to be going on as we're doing them. So let's just do this show. So I'm only getting to a few of the questions. I'm going as fast as I can through as many as I can. Paul Norton asks on Facebook, how do we reconcile Job 1 saying that Job was blameless? I translate as full of integrity with Romans 3:12 and the King James. So there's no one righteous, upright. They're all gone out of the way. They're together, become unprofitable. There's none that doeth good. No, not one. That's quoting from Psalm 14, Psalm 53. Byron Singh commented, Job was blameless, but there was something wrong happening in his house, which he had not dealt with. No, I reject that. I don't believe that's the case at all. Satan did not have access to his family. Satan did not have access to his children, to Job's possessions, without God's explicit permission. And what would be the meaning and lesson of the book if he suffered because there was sin in his household? So what do we learn through that? It's that he didn't deserve it. It wasn't expected. It says about Zechariah and Elizabeth in Luke 1, the parents of John the Immerser, that they were blameless according to the law. And Paul in Philippians 3 speaks of himself as righteous and blameless according to the law. And we know that many others, like Noah, was considered a Tom, blameless, full of integrity. So on the one hand, there was a righteousness according to the law where you could be blameless. You keep the commandments as best as you can. You seek to honor the Lord. Where you fall short, there's the sacrificial system and repentance, and you're everything's being checked off. But that doesn't deal with the ultimate problem of human sin atonement, because we all fall short still and need that ultimate atonement. With Job or Noah living outside of or before the Sinai covenant, these were God-fearing men who looked to him, who put their faith in him. They were not perfect. And Psalm 14, Psalm 53, quoted by Paul, are talking about the sinful, rebellious state of the human race as a whole. So in and of ourselves, compared to God, none of us is righteous. None of us. We all fall short. His righteousness is here, and we are infinitely short of that. On the flip side, is the fact that there are people that fear God and seek to live lives that are pleasing to him. So we still fall short, but God could say blameless, but I prefer to translate it full of integrity, because integrity, tum'ah, in the Hebrew, plays such an important role in the book. Job holding on to his integrity and Satan trying to destroy it, and even Job's wife challenging him on it, and God commending him for holding on to it. So that's related to Tom. So Tom, tum'ah. So tum'ah, integrity, Tom, I translate it with full of integrity to make that point. James Hodges, why is Job commended by God at the end of the book when Job, one, displays what could be called arrogance and how he challenged God of suffering, and two, has to be corrected by God in the end? I addressed that a little bit earlier in the broadcast, but Job 42, 7 and 8 were some of my favorite verses to comment on. I've done whole talks at, you know, apologetics conferences just focusing on those verses. But I'm going to read a few quotes. Norman Hobel, the blunt and forthright accusations of Job from the depths of his agony are closer to the truth than the conventional unquestioning pronouncements of his friends, or Krauss. Therefore, Job is better off than his friends, and Job's seeming blasphemy is more pleasing to God than the friends' conventional piety. Or in the words of Yechezkel Kaufman, the friends are guilty of cliches and empty phrases, while Job's challenge to God reflects a moral duty to speak only the truth before him. As Rayburn notes, Job's friends have insisted that Job's calamities were God's punishment for his sins. Job maintained that he had not brought this punishment on himself through sin. So the friends are saying things about God that are not true. Job is correct in what he's saying about God, but he draws conclusions from it that make God out to be unjust. It is for these wrong conclusions that Job has repented. Or Robert Gordas, far from denying Job's insistence that justice must somehow inhere in the universe, the Lord vigorously confirms it. Job has spoken the truth not only about his unmerited suffering, but about me, the nature of God. Thus, the book of Job demonstrates what could have been inferred a priori. A God without justice is no God to an ancient Hebrew. Now, I have more on this in one of the essays in the back on challenging God as an act of faith. So on the one hand, you are 100% right in terms of what Job got wrong. He spoke arrogantly. He accused God of wrongdoing and of being a moral monster. And God rebukes Job for that, plainly and strongly. And Job recants, humbles himself and recants. I blew it, puts his hand over his mouth, humbles himself, recants. But then God commends him for speaking what was right. What was right to say, the God I know is better than this. The God I know and worship is not like this. And somehow he has to vindicate himself. That was right. That was true, because those things did not reflect God's heart for Job, but rather the actions and heart of the enemy. Jonathan Burr, I'd love to hear your take on the suffering of Job being a blameless man versus the modern Word of Faith movement. As I mentioned in the first half of the broadcast, the modern faith movement and the carnal prosperity doctrine often have to come up with excuses for Job because, like, well, that doesn't fit my theology. And that's what we often do. Something doesn't fit our theology, so we have to demonize the person. Well, it doesn't happen over God. This is not going to happen to me because of what I believe. So you must be deviant somehow. Here's the issue. The problem, of course, is that Job is pictured as a righteous man, and the whole lesson of the book is based on his being a righteous, God-fearing man. Take that away, and the whole purpose of the book vanishes. At the same time, I do believe that there's a difference before the cross and after the cross. In other words, we have a revelation of Satan, even from later books of the Old Testament. I believe Job is written as a later book of the Old Testament rather than written as an early book. The account, what happened, is ancient. It's written in an ancient way, but it's written later in Israel's history. So the revelation of Satan that we have is something that Job did not have. They knew, Job and his friends knew about, you know, chaos powers and demonic powers and things, but this, the clear revelation of HaSatan, the adversary, and who he is, I don't believe they had that revelation, that insight, nor did they have the authority over Satan that we have through the cross. So on the one hand, Job is telling us that sometimes inexplicable things happen to righteous, godly people, and you just worship God anyway. And it could well be that the sickest person listening to me right now is the godliest person, and that the healthiest person listening to me right now is a wicked person. That could well be. It could well be that the person going through the most intense financial struggles right now is the godliest person, and the wealthiest person watching this right now is the least godly. That could well be. And things often go in this world the opposite of what we expect. At the same time, we should not look at ourselves as sitting ducks for the enemy, and that at any moment he can just come and steal and rob everything we have. In Jesus, we have authority over Satan that we should exercise. Let's see. Jeff Beamish, I hear that God would not allow suffering in a saint's life today. The Old Testament doesn't apply, and God would not allow suffering or cause it. Again, that ties in with one of the previous questions. But in short, what we are promised in the New Testament is not sickness, disease, and calamity, but rather persecution and resistance and hardship for the gospel. We are promised that in the New Testament, whereas the doctrine of blessing coming to the righteous or healing being the portion of the righteous, that's reaffirmed in the New Testament. But again, we are in a fallen world, and we know that there'll be sickness, pain, disease until we see the Lord. But what's promised us in the New Testament, there are wonderful promises of healing. So my first reaction to sickness is not to embrace it as a gift from God, but to pray for healing, or to do what I can to get healthier, or to go to a doctor, because I look at this as something negative and attack as opposed to a blessing from my Heavenly Father. Contrary to that, when I'm persecuted for the gospel, I look at that as a badge of honor. It may be coming from Satan and people, but I look at that as coming as a badge of honor. And lastly, Albert Wenzel, why did his wife work with Satan? Well, remember, she just lost her 10 children. She lost her 10 children. And here Job is just, well, praise the Lord, he's still good. And it's a bit much for her. And not only so, now her husband's smitten from head to toe, and he's lost everything, and he's out in the ash heap, and he's like, well, praise the Lord, either way. And maybe she just had it and spoke out against God, or maybe she couldn't take seeing her husband suffer anymore and just said, enough already, curse God and die, get it over with. But either way, God doesn't give Job a new wife at the end, does he? No, he blesses him with that same wife and 10 more children. So she ends up being part of the blessing. All right, remember, here's the book. Job, The Faith to Challenge God, a new translation and commentary. If you don't have it, I encourage you to get a copy of it. You'll find it to be worth every penny. And if you've been blessed by the book, take a minute, post a review on Amazon or Christian Book. It doesn't have to be short. Post a review to encourage others to check it out as well. What an amazing book of the Bible.